Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we'll be talking about the new age of space exploration. NASA is preparing for another manned trip to the moon. New technologies will be tested there before astronauts attempt to travel to Mars. And scientists are developing new ways to grow food and make fuel, equipment, and even pharmaceuticals from bacteria that can survive in a zero-oxygen environment. And in case you were wondering, the International Space Station is now open for business and is including hosting private astronauts. So perhaps you might get in line for that. But before we get to that, I wanted to ask a few questions. What will it take to get us to Mars? And what does the moon have to do with it? How can scientists learn and achieve things that can be applicable to life here on Earth? And what are the rules of engagement, if any, in this current era of space exploration, as other countries besides the U.S. also set their sights on so-called deep space? We have two guests here in the studio tonight to discuss these exciting innovations and their implications. First is Dr. Adam Arkin, senior faculty scientist in the Environmental Genomics and Systems Biology Division at UC Berkeley and leader of the new NASA Center for the Utilization of Biological Engineering in Space, also known as CUBES. Welcome, Adam.
Thank you.
And also joining us here tonight is Peter Fimwright. He is from the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's their lead science reporter, and he covers environmental, atmospheric, and ecosystem science. His recent series of articles on NASA's new priorities was the inspiration for tonight's show. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
And, of course, we'll invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. I'll give you that phone number now. It's toll-free, 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org. Follow us on Twitter or post on our Facebook page. So I wanted to start with you, Peter. You recently wrote a series of articles on NASA's new space program. What caught your interest when you heard about this?
Well, I think the main thing, I guess, would be they were talking about going there permanently and building a base on the moon and eventually going to Mars. And what that would entail, which would mean that they're going to have an orbiter that orbits around the moon and robots that maintain the orbiter, and they're going to try to find ice on the planet and water and hydrogen. And it's intriguing, I think, to everybody to think about what the possibilities are.
Does this seem to you like a new era from NASA's point of view? Like things had kind of been a little quiet for a while, and now suddenly there's new energy and new excitement?
It seems that way, yeah. I think it is a new era, and it's a new era of commercialization of space and of the moon. That's what administrators at NASA want. And they have actually contracted out with three companies to build lunar landers, and numerous other companies they hope to get involved with the exploration of the moon and eventually Mars.
And from your reporting, did you get a sense of what is driving this interest now, and particularly this public-private partnership, if I could call it that? You called it commercialization of space or of the moon.
Well, I would say, I think in 1969 when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, most people thought there would be commercialization of space by now. I remember seeing some cartoons about McDonald's on the moon way back when. So I don't think it's a big surprise that this is happening. But there has been a long period of time since this has been an emphasis. Mm-hmm. And recently, NASA's budget this year, $21.5 billion, is the best in the decade. So I think there's a renewed emphasis on that.
Hmm. So Adam Arkin, I asked the same question to you. Why now? What's coming together to really fuel this new era of space exploration?
I think it's convergence of a number of topics. I think, as Peter points out, it's taken a little while to get to the point where we knew how we could commercialize space. The first thing we commercialized, of course, was information space, right? We built the GPS systems. We built the satellites that move our radio signals and television signals around, communication satellites and the like. And that space is becoming ever more dense with utility in terms of just information observation and the like. The second thing, of course, is that as we did that, we realized that observation gives us an amazing view of Earth. And Earth is changing. Earth is changing because climate changes, because human habitation changes, land use changes. And one of the best views in the universe is sitting right above the planet. And our instruments can measure that. And what that does is it not only informs the world governments and scientists of what's going on, but informs commercial entities as well, agriculture and the like. And the other reason is, it's because there are resources in space that can be mined. Mm-hmm. Metals and other water, other things that are maybe not as important to us now, but because of the way that we're using our own resources, finding other sources of resources are very important. And finally, there's a problem of defense. And we don't talk about that much, but we are a nation that is driven in part by trying to defend our resources. And so having command of space is important to us. I think the good news is that, in general, space has been collaborative amongst the world's nations to date.
For now.
For now,
right?
Yeah.
So that's interesting. So you bring up, you bring up two very concrete things. This, what I've not heard so far is just kind of like, exploration for exploration's sake, or, we want to know what's out there. It's really, there's some very concrete things you're pointing to here, right? There are resources which are getting scarcer and scarcer here on Earth. And there's the kind of the new frontiers of how do we defend ourselves. Two very, very specific aims that you talk about. How do you, as a scientist, sort of, which mesh with those aims? Like, how do you evaluate their worth and how your science is being used to achieve those ends?
Well, I get the privilege of being the ivory tower scientist, and so I am motivated by the exploration first. But even that motivation is not even scientific. It's aspirational. It's what humans want to do. We want to go out and explore and find things and see things and meet things. I think that's what we want to do in the world. But we're interested in, where does life come from and how did it come to pass? How did our planet form? How does the universe form? And our ability to go out into the universe and find those things and see those things is what drives me to some degree. But honestly, I am very interested in Earth side. We are the only place where we know life exists at the moment. And we have a huge record of how life is changing over time. Other over natural and anthropogenic forces, meaning what we do to
the man-made.
Earth. Man-made. Mm-hmm. And I think that as we try to learn how to survive in the most extreme environment that we know of, which is space, we are learning how to survive better on Earth. And one of the hallmarks of the first space programs were this efflorescence of new technologies that have driven last century's innovations. And I think this next push is going to be that next big, hurdle, this next leap over the next big hurdle. How are we going to feed ourselves with reduced land and resource input? How are we going to clean up a dirty environment so it's habitable? How do we make things completely efficient and waste-free? I think those are things you have to do in space.
And why is that? Why do you have to go so far to learn how you can address problems that are right here at home, so to speak?
Oh, you don't. But it's a merciless testbed. I like to say that we're talking about with Peter earlier on about these topics, which is that on Earth you can order Amazon. If you get frustrated with things, just call Amazon. They'll send a truck. We're not motivated to solve the problems because we have such plenty at the moment. If you're on the moon, you got to call NASA, and they'll send something up in a day or two. You're on Mars, you're all alone, buddy. And solving that problem where you actually have to solve it is an extremely important way that humans operate. Necessity is the mother of invention.
Fair enough. So back to you, Peter. Tell us a little bit about what you learned about the current administration and how they are talking about how they're conceiving of these new explorations, both of the moon and then ultimately of Mars.
Well, like we said, commercialization, I think, is the main – is what Jim Bridenstine has talked about quite a bit. And I think part of it has to do – it's also a kind of a space race for resources. I mean, China landed landed on the moon earlier this year and germinated some seeds, and I think there's a bit of competition going on there also. So,
and that's just not a small thing that they were able to do that.
No, that's a big deal. And the European Space Agency is talking about mining ice. They want to do that. Israel, India landed on the moon. They sent probes up there earlier in the year. So I mean, I think a bit of it is competition. You know, that's going to drive commercialization, I think, as we go along. And I think that's a primary motivator, I believe.
Mm-hmm. So we mentioned in the intro that in order to get to Mars, you got to stop at the moon. So tell us a little bit more, Adam Arkin, why that? Because we just never made it to Mars before, so you want to kind of do things incrementally, or is there some? What's the logic behind why the moon has a lot to do with how we get to Mars?
I'm sure I'm going to get this wrong, but I'll take a stab. Listen, you know, space is unforgiving. As I said, it's one of the great things about the engineering of space travel is not only are you engineering for efficiency and effect, but you're engineering for risk tolerance. You're trying to de-risk everything because you can't afford an accident. It's just too much money, too many lives. So you need a place where you can stage that out in some safety. And that's one place you can do it is the moon. I think as Peter points out, there's also resources there to play with. The second piece is that the moon might be a good staging place for launch or something like that. So there may be reasons why you want to be above the gravitational well a little bit as you begin to, you know, boost things up into Mars, into a Mars shot, or for building things that you need to put onto a rocket that's going to go, and you need a forward base for that purpose. And but I think that a lot of it has to do with just establishing what is the protocols by which humans can live for extended times in such extreme conditions effectively.
So this is a staging area that has a little less risk, but not no risk.
Not no risk, yeah.
Compared to Mars. Is that what you got, Peter, when the administrator Bridenstine said that, you know, we're going to go to the moon and we're going to stay there?
Yeah, that's what I got. And I don't think that would have happened if they hadn't found hydrogen on the moon in 1998. It was first found in a crater. And in 2009, they crash-landed a spent rocket in a crater and found all kinds of heavy metals and gases and ice and ammonia, gold even. I don't. Maybe this wouldn't be happening if they hadn't discovered those things.
Hmm. And so what do you make of that statement that, you know, this time we're going to go there and we're going to stay there? What is that actually going to look like, Adam Arkin?
Wow, that's a.
And I mean the moon at this point.
Yeah. So there's two ways of looking at that problem. Technologically, I think this looks like how do you build a sustainable habitation for a fair number of people. I think we're talking about, you know, tens of people from each nation, for example, who might be up there at a given moment, maybe more. And you know, you talked about rules of engagement earlier, and what is our duty to this planetoid, this thing that we're on? You know, how much damage can we do to it, so to speak? So part of it's going to be trying to figure out how to build an urban design that is respectful of that object, because NASA is very respectful of places we haven't been before.
Except they crash landed a rocket in there, didn't they?
Well, yes, but it's a small rocket. Small rocket. Small infections, you know, start with big ones. But I think that the other thing is, how do you build these sort of cities so that they can do their jobs well? I think the other interesting thing is going to be what is going to be the evolving geopolitical structure of the moon. And I don't know. I mean, you've seen independent nation actions, you know, landing objects up there with different emphases for what they want to discover and understand. And the question is going to be, how do you parcel it up? And how are we going to build those agreements? And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe Peter does.
You know, it's interesting. I'm glad you're bringing that up, because it makes me think of, you know, so much of the of the troubles, to say the least, an understatement of that, what we have on Earth is how it's been, you know, divvied up, right? So how's it going to be different this time around? I don't know that you have the answer to that, Peter, but what have you heard about thoughts about how this is all going to work as people are elbowing their way?
Well, a big part of it is what Adam's doing, which is studying how to grow things, grow food and medicine and plants and in space, which his work is focused on Mars, but it's going to have to be tested somewhere, and I believe the moon will be it. But the other part of it is robotics. They're going to have a capsule out there that's the plan is to have an orbiter, actually, the Gateway orbiter, which will orbit around the moon, and astronauts will come to it and use that as a jumping-off point for the moon. That's the plan. But it's going to be empty half the time, you know, possibly. You know, as long as a year, it'll be empty. So they're going to have – and you can't leave things just alone with no maintenance in space. Lots of things can go wrong. So the plan is to have robots. That's what they want to do. They have these Astro B robots that float around and have arms that can grab things and replace stuff and detect whether there's leaks. And they, there's testing those right now in the International Space Station. And the hope is that eventually these robots can, while astronauts are not there, maintain the orbiter. And probably greet astronauts as they dock in there, hand them a gin and tonic, maybe.
Right. So, but who's going to control access to the moon? I guess is one of the things Adam's point was making me think of. You know, who's creating these orbiters, and then who gets to dock with them? And is it all comers? Is it whoever put it there first? I mean, how's that playing out? Did you get any information about that, I guess, in your reporting?
Well, that's a good question. I think that's a question that hasn't been addressed yet. I mean, I guess it's the first person there, really. Whoever's there and creates the biggest base has, you know, it's whoever plants that flag there, I suppose, at this point. But I think that's probably what's coming, is some sort of regulations and jurisdiction and rules and laws in space will have to be developed, I think, for
right. And the
work.
Question is, what will cause them? Is it going to be proactive or reactive to get us to that place? My producer reminds me that the United Nations has an outer space treaty. I don't know if that's exactly what it's called, but it's. And it's been signed by a number of countries. I'm not sure if the U.S. is a signatory to this, but that no nation can claim sovereignty on the moon. How do you see that playing out, Adam Arkin?
Yeah, well, I was going to get to this. So there has been a longstanding charter about how space gets divvied up, even how the orbits are used and who gets to put a satellite where. And then there's been conflict over that, as you know. I think the moon is a little bit of a unchallenged area. There's been general agreement about what, you know, mission planning, and people inform each other what's going on, but it's been more of a gentleman's agreement. And I think that the first time you'll see change is when there is a commercial or defense interest that gets triggered. I think we're very bad. This is a personal opinion now, but no one I work for believes this. I think the first time people tend to act when there's something to act on. And so my favorite, sort of harmless example is, imagine Elon Musk goes and establishes a Tesla dealership on the, on the moon. Well, someone's going to start going, well, why does he have the rights to sell cars there? And I think that's when it becomes challenged in court or international court, and we'll start seeing people thinking about the law in a more practical sense than just the agreements that you have in the general sense of we're doing science.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like, as often is the case, the science is moving much faster than the legal infrastructure can to keep up with it, because it's the questions aren't even – some of the questions we can imagine and pose here right now, and a lot we can't even possibly imagine.
That's right.
Right. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and streaming live on the web at KALW.org through one of those satellites that are up there, right? I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the new age of space exploration. What would – it look like to have the moon for sale? What do you think about this new era and the clear ideas about going to the moon for resources and to defend our turf and perhaps get to Mars one day? What does a conversation like this make you think about? Does it make you wonder? Does it make you excited? Does it cause concern? We'd like to hear from you, our listeners. Our number is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KALW website, or follow us on Twitter at cityvisions. KALW. So maybe we'll get back to some of those ethical, legal questions a little bit later. But now I wanted to get into some of the not so science fiction, which is, really, what does it take to test how long people, humans, can live in deep space, and especially when they're in a place with zero resources, at least that we know about at this point. So there's been a lot of discussion about, how you're going to potentially get there, dock there, get on the surface of the moon. But once you get there, there's a lot of questions that are being posed at this point about how are people going to be able to eat, and how are they going to be able to cure illnesses that may occur? How are you going to create a sustainable environment on one that is at this point not hospitable to human life? So Adam, why don't you start kind of unpacking that question for us with a few things that are in the works to try to understand what people are going to need and how we're going to get those needs met?
Absolutely. So obviously people have a lot of needs when they're far from home. They need air, and they need food, and they need medicine. They need
water.
They need water. They need space. Sometimes they need isolation from other people. but we have to satisfy the very basic things first. And so the first thing you have to satisfy, of course, are things like air and recycling, the fact that we make waste and we have to get rid of it. And we don't want to just pack it up, because that's very valuable materials that we excrete. So we want to take that material, and we want to take material that's available on the moon or on Mars, and then turn it into other things. And there are one way you can do this, if you want to do this sustainably without having to ship things from Earth all the time, is to use organisms that have evolved on Earth to use almost nothing and make things. So as you might know, there are organisms that live, 2.4 kilometers down South African gold mine and behind a rock wall, and somehow live off, water and limestone and radiolytically cleaved water. And there are organisms that live at the bottom of Arctic lakes and in deserts. And the way that they do this is they are so-called autotrophs. They can take in just carbon dioxide and light, or just carbon dioxide and heat and energy. And they can manufacture themselves. But what themselves are complex chemical materials, very complex chemical materials. And they can make things like protein, which we want to eat, and sugar, which makes things sweet, and other molecules that look like drugs. So those of us who study these organisms figure out how you can choose an organism who could live in these conditions more without a lot of modification or with a lot of air conditioning, so to speak, and coax them into making things for people. The other thing you can do, of course, is that plants can grow there too, not in on an exposed lunar surface, but you can put them into systems that allow them to use very little resource. Remember that a tree is just air made solid. You know, they are autotrophs themselves. They take very little nutrient from the soil. They use carbon dioxide to make that entire structure. So you can grow them in those same conditions with a little bit more conditioning, and they can eat the small amount of nutrients that these organisms that we engineer give them, and they can make food for astronauts. Now, one thing that we've learned is that astronauts like to have real food. You know, astronaut ice cream and, you know, power bars are just not enough after a few months.
Yeah, Tang just doesn't cut it.
Oh. We just got a whole bunch. I didn't know they even still existed. We just got a big box of Tang for the lab.
I like Tang.
It's pretty, right? They want to see green. They want crunch. They want variety. You know, all these things. And plants provide that. The other thing that plants provide, interestingly enough, is that they provide the means of making drugs that bacteria cannot. Because they're much more like us. Plants are much more like us than bacteria. And so they can make drugs that look like molecules that we would normally use, like antibodies. And so our colleagues in CUBES, for example, at UC Davis is a woman named Karen McDonald and Soman Nandi, a guy who works with them, who are engineering plants to make antibody drugs that can support bone density health so that when you're in low gravity, your bones won't decay. And you can just eat the plant to get this drug. And so the ability to turn the water that we find on the moon and that we bring with us, that we recycle from ourselves, the carbon dioxide that we breathe out, and to turn those into these complex molecules, these pharmaceuticals and these foods and these plastics that we use to build stuff, that allows you to be self-reliant and not require delivery from Earth.
This is like the perfect utopian zero emission, zero waste dream.
It is. I love
the way you describe it.
Yeah. Well, I think for Mars, our target is to support up to like 9 astronauts for 9 months or more, year and 3 months for the orbit. You know, in a completely self-contained environment with minimal waste. And can you imagine in an object the size of a shipping container? You know, like one of those Matson containers you see out on the bay. You know, and that, imagine you could do that for the population of San Francisco without the transportation of lots of food from place to place, without burning that carbon, recycling our wastes, doing it in our homes. It would change the way that the economy works, for sure, which has its own consequences. But not having that waste and being able to use our resources that efficiently would be immensely powerful for us. And necessary in 60 years or so.
Mm. Okay. You're talking about necessary in order to be able to sustain human life on the moon or Mars, but you're also saying necessary for the way things are heading here on Earth.
I think so. Absolutely.
I want to bring a caller in. We have Jeff from Oakland. Jeff, welcome to City Visions.
Hi, thank you. Loving the show here. Just to play a little bit of a devil's advocate to this. I think you guys are probably both familiar with the exceptional success of programs like the New Horizons program that went, you know, discovered lots of stuff about the planets, took a lot of pictures, went to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, you know, other sort of purely robotic space missions like the Hubble telescope and Curiosity rover, on and on. My point is, maybe... I mean, it just seems like we're jumping way ahead with this manned aspect, and we do a lot more with robotics, trying to drill into the ice of Europa, you know, stuff, just exploring as much as we can with robotics and telescopes out in space, and then keep the manned activity. I think we can get all that benefit and get all that innovation and experimentation here closer to home, just kind of orbiting our own planet, space station, cooperative programs. But, you know, when you talk about the 3-day something journey to the moon or what have you, you have to sustain these pink bodies that pee and poop, and just a big, it just turns into a big ordeal, and robots could do it so much cheaper and maybe better.
And safer, maybe?
And maybe safer.
Maybe safer.
Stuff like that. And just all this mining, and, you know, we're going to mine metals out in space and bring it back. I mean, it's just like, I don't know. Keep it local, you know, kind of thing. I don't know. That's just my point is, let's reassess and just really, you know, give some praise to sort of like the New Horizons program or some of these robotic programs, and maybe emphasize those. And, of course, we're curious. We're humans. We're going to go to space. We're not going to not do that. But let's just do it. Let's just have a nice orbiting space party out in the nice, you know, Burning Man satellite. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't have to be we have to go to the moon and just set up missions and grow food. We can actually do all that experimentation right here in orbit, you know, for much cheaper, closer to home, and do both. I don't know. What do you think? That's my question.
Well, thanks so much, Jeff, for your provocative question there. Yes. So, Adam, you've been smiling there. What do you make of Jeff's concerns?
Well, first of all, I definitely want to go to the Burning Man space station, whatever that is.
Me too.
I'm going there. Yeah. Right. Second, no. I'm a great fan of robots, and I think robots should go everywhere. And I think we should have von Neumann machines, things, self-replicating robots, to go out to the universe and figure out how to, you know, get beyond the stars. I think there's lots of things we're going to do there, and it's immensely valuable. And certainly is going to be the bulk of what we do in space is going to be robotic. However, there are things that humans do that robots can't. And there are problems that we want to solve for humanity in the challenge of space that robots won't give us the opportunity to solve. And to be very frank with you, this is more of a poetic object. I think there is a truly inspirational view of humans going out into space I don't know how to explain it. It's the idea that we are here and coming out. It seems very motivating, and I think humanity needs the sense of aspiration that we can do together, and space provides that sort of integrative place to cooperate. I do think that there is technical reasons to do this. I think that being able to really push the bounds of zero waste production and sustainable production is a place where this can really happen. I think the pushing the bounds of what it takes to sustain human life in extreme conditions is very important. I think that there are things we're going to learn about science that a robot can't do because humans are creative on the site, that robots can't be creative on that site in the same way. And until we're there, we won't know. And I think that's part of it as well. So, yes, I think we should have robots everywhere. I think we should have the Burning Man in space, but I think we should really seriously think about putting humans for long periods in colonization situations.
And what is it, again, that keeps us from being able to do those things right here, run those experiments and scale them up right here? I think that was really what Jeff was trying to get at.
I think we should. I think we should do it in our oceans, number one. I think the oceans are unexplored, and I think there's a fantastic extreme environment we can do this in, and we should do it there. It would really behoove us to do that. I think a lot of it comes from you find impetus, you find power where many people's interests converge. And so space is a place where many interests converge at the moment, and I think will in the future. And so it's a place where many human endeavors can come together and leverage each other. And so why not do it there? We are not doing it on Earth at the moment because the interests haven't converged there yet.
But perhaps they will.
And the innovations that Adam is doing with recycling and all that wouldn't happen if wouldn't be happening probably on the scale they are if there wasn't this plan to go to the moon and Mars.
Let me reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight, we're talking about the new age of space exploration with our guests, Dr. Adam Arkin, Senior Faculty Scientist in the Environmental Genomics and Systems Biology Division at UC Berkeley, and leader of the new NASA Center for the Utilization of Biological Engineering in Space, also known as CUBES, and Peter Fimwright, a lead scientist reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle, who's covered the environment, the atmosphere, ecosystem science, and a recent series on NASA's new push to get to Mars via the moon. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also email us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So before we took the call there from Jeff, we were talking about how we're going to create this tight, perfectly efficient system that's going to be able to use human waste and other resources to be able to generate a self-sustaining environment for humans in space. So tell us, how do you actually figure that out?
Well, let's go back to the robots. So one of the great things that we have accomplished over many years in space has been the measurement of the bodies we're going to. We've had rovers on Mars for decades, and they've told us a lot about what goes on the surface. We've had orbiters around Mars that tell us its atmosphere and where the water is and things like this. And so we get a sense of what resources are present there and what the extremes are and how particle storms work and all these things. Orbital mechanics tells us how the planet moves and the like. From the space station and from moonshots with people in it, we've learned how people survive in space and what their needs are and how much energy they use. And how many times they can move their elbow until it starts hurting. I mean, NASA's very exacting about these things. And so we have models of how humans operate in space and what they need. And so we get what's called a reference mission architecture, something that says, hey, if we go to Mars, what do you need to make this so? We know that Mars' closest approach to Earth is around 23 million miles, and it's or 32 million miles, and the farthest one is 250 million miles, and so we know what the orbit has to be and how long we have to stay there so we can go back to the shortest distance. We know how we're going to shoot a rocket off from Earth to get there. We know how long that will take. We know what we need to sustain people going there and on that planet. So given all that stuff, what's there, what people need, we then have to match technology to get there.
And what are the limits to what you can figure out here on Earth, and what are the what do you have to prepare for when you put people on the moon or head them towards Mars? Because you have to make a lot of very educated guesses, I imagine, about how it's all going to work.
Yeah, so here on Earth, we can do the basic human physiology quite well, for example, and we can make simulations of the life support systems and put people inside them and see if they do their job more or less. And we can simulate the plant growth chambers and the microbial growth chambers and ask if they do their job here. And we can try to build simulations of the environments that we're going to be in. So we have these metal chambers or that we can draw down the pressure and make very, very cold. And we can say, can something operate in that condition? And so we can test out a lot of the unit operations, individual operations here on Earth. And what NASA is very good at is staging those systematic designs. Let's test this object first, then this object, and then how they hook together, and then in more and more extreme conditions. But the fact is, until you're actually in space at the gravitational conditions you need to be at and the radiation conditions that you have to be at and so on, you don't know. So each stage is then moved up to the space station, and then it will be staged on the moon, probably first with automatic systems, and then we'll start moving people up there.
And what was the time frame that Peter that you heard about as you did your reporting for all this, and what seems realistic to you? I know there's been some controversy there.
Yeah, well, originally it was 2028 is when NASA was planning to go to the moon, put people back on the moon. And Mike Pence, the vice president, mentioned in March that it just declared that we're going to the moon in 5 years. So that that schedule was quickly changed to 2024.
So and what did he base his date on?
Well, that's a good question. That's something I don't know. The question whether they can get there, whether it can all be done by 2024, is up for debate. I mean, I'm not an expert enough to know whether that's possible. But they do seem to be ramping things up and getting ready to go. And funding, contractors to build landers and, so we'll see, I guess.
So what do you make of that? I heard a sigh from you there, Adam. What do you make of that timeline? And is it because are things being accelerated because somehow there's a sense that now we're in a race?
I don't know what our leaders are necessarily thinking. My sigh was more about I'm impressed with the speed. I always like a challenge. I think it's really nice to have a challenge. I think if anyone can do it, NASA can. Why is it happening right now? I do think that there is an increasing realization that there is a great deal of opportunity in space, and you've seen it in our name brand companies, right? I mean, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk and other famous businessmen have started to launch companies to start to exploit space. And so, when you begin to see private industry ramping up in the way that it has, and you begin to see the bandwidth, the amount of space you have available in space beginning to become limited, then you want to be up there first and know and have command of that, of an agency in that space. And so I think that's what we're seeing. We're seeing that we're realizing how quickly people can move into that arena. And so we should accelerate our nation's view of that.
And my question then, my follow-up question is then, given what you know now and what you don't know, you actually don't know what you don't know, but what is the risk of pushing this too fast? I imagine the margin of error is not that great here.
Right. I mean, I my sense is that we're not dealing with an agency that's going to risk its people. they don't want that. They're not going to rush to make that happen. But I think that we talked about a lot of the implications of being able to put more and more people and objects into our near Earth environment, and what that means technologically and politically. And so I think the danger is not thinking it through, and not coming to a good collaborative agreement on how to make this the best for everybody. If we move too quickly, we're not thinking well. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see us think well. I think technologically, NASA's been thinking about things like this for decades and decades, and I think they're capable of mobilizing. But getting all the people to agree and logistically operating that across all the nations, that's something I think would take a little bit of time.
But you can't really ignore the possibility that, there have been three major disasters in NASA's history, and that is possible. I mean, 1967, three people were killed on the Apollo 1 when electrical failure, and everybody knows about the Challenger disaster and the Columbia disaster, and all of these things were, I think, at least they were things that were overlooked. And that can happen. If you rush through, that's a possibility. You are risking, you could be risking people's lives. And, right now they haven't even built the SLS rocket, which they're planning, which is the most, it's the most powerful rocket NASA's ever built. And it's not built yet.
Or plans to build.
they have plans, yeah. Nor do they have the Orion capsule, which would hold the astronauts. So, I mean, there's a lot to do. Or the Gateway orbiter. That's, you know, those things are going to be tested in the next few years, couple of years. But those aren't built yet. Mm-hmm. And there's only 5 years. It's pretty quick.
I mean, I suppose the question, I mean, I agree with you, absolutely. I think the question is whether or not they'll do the full mission that you're describing in 5 years, or they'll, you know, move the goalpost a little bit and just ask, can we get a person up there?
Right.
You know, and I don't think in 5 years you can do the full mission you're describing. Just the number of moving parts is large.
Yeah, but I wonder what aspect they'll do. Will they send the orbiter up or what? You know, landers, I guess.
That's a good question. Yeah. I think that's the what's the vertical pole in the tent, and that's not my expertise.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's something they'd have to think it through.
This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about the new age of space exploration with our guest, Dr. Adam Arkin at UC Berkeley and the leader of the new NASA Center for the Utilization of Biological Engineering in Space, also known as CUBES, and Peter Fimwright, lead science reporter at the San Francisco Chronicle. The number to dial to join our conversation is 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment to the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So we talked about the infrastructure there. You mentioned, Peter, about what's going to get us to the moon again. Let's turn our attention to Mars for a moment. So what sets of questions or challenges do you see making the next step? Are you already thinking about that next step? Or are the questions you're asking about the moon really questions you're asking about Mars here?
Yeah, so actually CUBES is set up for a Mars mission as opposed to a moon mission. And part of that's because the need for a completely self-contained production and manufacturing system is much higher when you can't deliver from Earth so easily and you have a long extended stay. And so a lot of our work is how do you use these how do you minimize what you have to bring along with you, because every ounce of material put onto a rocket is extremely expensive. So you want to minimize that amount of mass that you bring with you, and you want to utilize as much as possible what Mars grants you. And what Mars grants you is a lot of carbon dioxide, a little bit of nitrogen, and a fair amount of water, and some light. And so the question is, how do you take just those things and turn that into what astronauts need, and then take whatever is wasted and recycle it? And so there, again, it's about how do you turn those resources into things that biology can use properly. And Mars provides an unforgiving environment for that job, but also a very well-specified one. So one of the great things about solving problems is if someone tells you, here's the actual problem, and it's very precise, then it's easier to come up with a solution than when it's vague. And so in the case of Mars, we know exactly what we need to do to sustain that group of people with those resources. So that's what we're doing in CUBES, is staging that out. How do you take carbon dioxide and nitrogen and make that into ammonia and sugars? How do you take ammonia and sugars and turn that into fertilizer for the plants and food for the bacteria that make plastics? And then how do you turn that into final food and medicine and building materials for astronauts on Mars? Now, all of that can be done on the moon as well. Don't get me wrong, although the moon doesn't have the atmosphere that Mars has. But it's not as necessary because we're much closer to the moon than we are to Mars. And so we can drop stuff up that are much cheaper than we can to Mars. So the moon is a place where we can make this happen, but we won't have the same constraints. We won't have the amount of carbon dioxide that we have on Mars. We won't have the amount of nitrogen that we have on Mars, or the amount of water for that matter. So it's a different constraint.
Hmm. So I wanted to shift back to kind of how our conversation began, which is, why explore in space? What's the real? What are the real drivers here? Resources, such as water and metals. I heard there's gold there, right? there's gold on the moon. And then there's also the defense concerns. I'm going to put the defense stuff on to the side because I don't think either of you are that's not your thing. But let's talk about the resources. So there's the resources that we can mine from the moon, and I don't know if there's any thoughts of mining things from Mars or if it's too far away to be useful. But then there's also the question of the technology that you've been describing so far, Adam, and applying it to some of the real world, so to speak, problems that we have here. What does that loop look like? How do we get what you are testing in your lab that then you're going to refine on the moon and then perhaps bring to Mars? How do you then bring that loop back to Earth and bring those technologies to bear on problems we're contending with here?
Well, I think that's one of the big advantages of the commercialization drive that's happening in space, which is that we are more and more involved with these public-private partnerships where, you know, the ivory tower academics like myself are privileged to work with people who are trying to actually, you know, get things to work out there. And when we do that, you know, the entrepreneurs and the people from our laboratories who become entrepreneurs can see what the applications are and turn the things that we're building in a lab or for space into things that move to Earth. And we've seen that in the space program to date. And it happens when companies become expert in, for example, a positioning system or expert in, you know, in integrated circuits or in propulsion or fuel utilization and things like this. And in our case, it's going to be we're going to be expert in how to make food with almost no resources and turn that waste back into something else. And so even right now on Earth, we see concerns doing this. So urban farming is something that's sprouted up. We have a number of companies in San Francisco, but across the nation, which are trying to figure out how do you build completely hydroponic, LED-fed, high-density farms that are in warehouses, and how do you make that happen? And so, as we begin to try to learn how to do that in space, we expect to partner with those concerns as well, who are teaching us what they've learned that we can translate to space, and we teach them what we've learned they can translate to Earth. And I think it's supporting that sort of interchange between the federal agency, academia, and industry that I think will be the way that cycle works.
Is that something that's actually deliberate at this point, or is that just, again, aspirational on your part that you could see that happening? But are there people who are already thinking about how you can apply what you create and learn in space right here on Earth?
I think it's absolutely deliberate. It's absolutely deliberate. We are specifically looking for those sorts of partnerships all the time. And I think NASA encourages us to get industry involved in our advisory boards and things like that. And we look to see if we can get together. And there are people who are advocating in the Bay Area to bring these people together. For example, I have a friend of mine, John Cumbers, who used to be a NASA Ames employee. And he started a conference system called SynBioBeta, which is for synthetic biology, and translating that out of the academic labs into industry. And recently he started, SynBio or Beta Space, I guess, which is trying to nucleate an industry around, space industry and academia. And I think we're seeing more and more of that sort of recognition that having those two things together are very powerful.
You mentioned a couple of other things that you're hoping to be able to create in space with very little resources and zero waste. You talked about medicines and you talked about building materials. How do you see those things scaling up here on Earth?
Yeah, I think the medicines are very powerful, actually, to tell you the truth. So we already do a lot of biotechnological production of medicines. As it stands, we do it with bacteria and fungi and mammalian cells. I think that the idea of making medicines on demand, where we know what the genes are that would be necessary for an organism to make something for yourself, and being able to on-demand program an organism to make that drug. So the bits to bugs, you know, taking this electronic understanding of this, these are the sequences that would do it, and then turning that immediately into an organism that can make it. That's something that this sort of work pushes for, because we don't know all the illnesses that an astronaut's going to make, right? Going to have. And so we want to be able to transmit the solution to Mars and have the bugs and plants make that for us on demand. And having that sort of on-demand medicine, I think, can be very powerful for us. The other thing is that we're finding new modalities. How do you make it so that you don't have to do all this purification? How do you make it so that it's perfectly safe to ingest right out of the jar? It's something that's very different than what our industry does right now. And if you imagine us being able to make those drugs that cheaply and on demand and on site, that's going to change the way we think about pharmacy and medicine. Building materials are another example of this. Our ability to create what we want from organisms is very interesting. So I'm unfortunately blanking on the name of this company, but for example, one company is working on how do you take mycelia fungus. These are fungus that make basically mushrooms, but they make these materials that are basically like concrete. But before they're concrete, you can form them into chairs and tables and other objects and functionalize them. And the things that we make are plastics, so you can literally put them into 3D printers. And these are all sustainable and reusable and recoverable. And so being able to make things like everything in this room, the chairs and these tabletops and some of the buildings, some of the materials on the ceiling here, are all from organisms that can take waste and turn it into this material and then degrade this material and turn it back into feedstocks. That's going to be very, very powerful for maintaining a renewable economy.
That's quite inspiring, considering what we're up against here on Earth in terms of issues of sustainability and climate change. Peter, any last thoughts or comments about what you've learned about what NASA is proposing, and what questions kind of are front and center in your mind about how this is all going to work?
Well, I guess we've talked a lot about the timing and whether that's possible, and and we also mentioned earlier about the industry and what the benefit of getting corporations involved, and I think part of that is that it's funding. They help Adam do his work. And build things up to scale too. That would be one of the benefits. I think my main question would be whether it can be done and in the timely fashion that they want it to be done, and what it's going to look like in the end is kind of sort of fascinating to me. I mean, Adam's work is fascinating. I mean, it's basically building a biological loop where you emit all your sweat and everything, it comes back and you build things with it. All of it's fascinating to me. I'm just interested in finding out how it ends up.
Well, I guess we'll have to stay tuned, literally, to find out more. Well, I want to thank my guests this evening, Dr. Adam Arkin, UC Berkeley professor and leader of the new NASA Center for the Utilization of Biological Engineering in Space, and Peter Fimwright, lead science reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at kalw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join me next Monday when I speak with Dr. Shalil Jain to discuss her debut book, The Unspeakable Mind, Stories of Trauma and Healing from the Front Lines of PTSD Science. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.
Fly me to the moon.